We interview Macworld senior editor Chris Breen.
We've got updates to QuickTime, iTunes, and Apple TV.
All that and more. My Mac Podcast 132.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
I am Tim Robertson, sitting next to Chad Perry in the sweltering hot Michigan office. And how's the weather over there in Virginia, guy?
Oh, it's just about as hot. Probably, you know, low 90s.
Oh, well, it's probably low 90s here, or close to it, but a lot of humidity. Yeah. So, and none of our listeners care.
No, probably not.
We're actually, again, recording in reverse order. We already did the interview with Chris Breen. Chad and I did earlier in the hour, and now we're going to jump in here with Guy Searle to begin the podcast with all the lovely Mac news. Mm-hmm. And I say the lovely because there's actually a lot of news this week.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness, because, you know, there's nothing like doing a weekly Apple podcast, and there's nothing to talk about.
Nothing to say.
Right. Well, at least as far as news goes.
Hey, it's the MyMac.com podcast. Good night, everybody.
Definitely. And this is the last show for our Audible.com sponsorship. So we want to thank Audible for the month of May.
Yes.
They sponsored this as well as our MyMac.com website. And thanks a lot. We appreciate it. And they've got a really cool product. I've always been a fan of Audible.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that I've ever heard has always been positive about their customers when they're very happy.
Yep.
You just listen to Leo Laporte because, coincidentally, Audible also did Mac Break Weekly. So Audible was hitting the podcast circuit in May, and thankfully we were one of those that they hit. And hopefully everybody that's listening at least signed up for a free trial. And if you haven't, you still have time. Go up to MyMac.com and click the top banner. How's that for my
advertising
very good spiel?
And yes, thank
because
you.
Because if
Audible.
You can hear it,
it's Audible, baby.
I never did tell him that we've been saying that. I mean, I probably oughta. If it's Audible, no. See, I always screw it up.
Yeah.
I made it up. I made it up, and I screw it up.
And you can't say.
I can't say it. So there is a lot of news to get into, but first of all, and this is something that we actually talked about with Chris Breen, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. On stage together for over an hour.
Wow!
Did you watch any of that, guy?
No, I haven't had a chance to watch it because I mean, today is being Thursday. They just did it last night,
right?
And most of the video wasn't available until
they have
today.
All seven parts.
I was already at work.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's embedded. This is actually entertaining enough for me, anyways. Being a tech guy that I am. And a history buff when it comes to technology, especially when it comes to Microsoft and Apple, because their histories really are tightly interwoven, especially at the beginning of the Mac platform, and the Apple II, for that matter.
Yeah.
That it's a treat to have the main guys at that time together at the same time on the stage talking to each other and Walt Mossberg, the host. It's a treat, and it's something that you're not going to probably ever see again quite like this. I'm sure they'll
It wasn't a cage match then?
No, not at all. They have a contentious relationship in business, and I don't even know if the two guys really like each other that much. I don't know. But
there's no reason why they can't be, pleasant.
Well, they still make a lot of money off each other.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Microsoft makes a lot of money off of Apple by selling a lot of really good Apple software.
Yep.
And Apple makes a whole lot of money off of Microsoft for customers getting sick of the Windows operating system and jumping to the Mac. So it works both ways.
Right.
Well, not to mention also Office for the Mac.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said, though, that they make a lot of money off of Apple because they write great software.
Well, yeah, but that kind of works the other way around as well, is that, Apple is able to entice people to use the Mac because Office is available.
Exactly. Yep. So they were up on stage together. Just Google search it. It's All Things Digital Conference, and you will find all seven parts of the video. Mm-hmm. I watched the highlight reel. It really wasn't enough for me, so I started watching all seven videos. Not at the same time. I'm mm-hmm. not that good. Plus, it'd probably crash my browser. But I'm partway through the third part of it, and I find it highly entertaining. Not so informative. I mean, most of the stuff I already knew because mm-hmm. I've been following this for 12 years at this mm-hmm. point, and it's really interesting. So anybody listening want to check that out? Definitely Google it, watch it. It's very informative, and if you're fairly young, you really don't understand the history of Apple and where they've come from. This is something worth watching. You're really going to get an education.
And then go watch Pirates of the Silicon Valley.
Yeah, well, some of that is a little. Although I have to say that, what is this, Noel Wiley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did a good job as Steve Jobs, I think. I think he did pretty good.
Well, I mean, they actually had him, they had him come up on stage, I think, not the last Macworld, but the
No, it was, you know, it was.
Was it farther
three
back
or four years ago now, yeah.
Oh, was it? Yep. Oh, okay.
And Bill Gates actually said, and by the way, no, I'm not the fake Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fantastic. That was just great.
Or their secret marriage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Apple stock almost up to $120 a share. And remember,
actually, it's above $120
as we record this.
At the close on Thursday, I think it was $122.
So, and remember, this is post-split a few times. So mm-hmm. if you bought Apple stock at its low in around 1996, you could afford a nice new house right now, probably. I mean,
just about.
I wish I would have had the disposable income back in 96. Because, mm-hmm. I was covering Apple and all that at the time. And everybody was predicting doom and gloom, and I mm-hmm. was still thinking and saying publicly, no, Apple's fine. They're going to weather mm-hmm. this storm, and they're going to be a better company for it. And I was right. But I just didn't put my money where my mouth was.
You didn't have the money to put there, though.
No, but still, I mean, you know, even if at its low, I think Apple was around $18 a share,
mm-hmm.
and that was
it was like 12.
Yeah, and that was before it split. So imagine if I would have somehow got $1,000 together mm-hmm. and bought it.
I think they've actually had two splits.
Might have been
since '96.
Yeah, I don't follow because Apple's.
It's low just before the iMac came out. I think its low was around $12 a share.
Yeah.
So if you'd bought like 1,000 shares at $12 a share, it split twice, and now it's worth over $120. You're doing okay.
Yeah, you're buying a nice car, mm-hmm. possibly a house, depending on where you live. So I don't follow the stock market at all, and the only reason I mention Apple stock price here is because I think it shows the health of the company,
mm-hmm.
and everybody listening to this podcast has a vested interest in the health of Apple Computer. I don't think it helps anybody, even the other tech companies, for Apple to be struggling.
Right.
What else do you got on there, Guy?
We got new iMacs and MacBook Pros that are rumored for WWDC.
Well, I think both of those need.
Oh yeah.
Big
time update.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not just processor. I really think it's time, and we've mentioned this in the past. I think it's time for a new look to the MacBook Pro line.
MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they look exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Slight changes.
Like 2003?
Boy, no, even before that. I remember somebody had a 15-inch PowerBook G4, 500 megahertz. And it just, the aluminum, it was sleek. I really wanted one. I had a Lombard at the time. But I really wanted one because it was just so cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that much different now than it was then.
No.
So this has got to be, don't you agree, this has got to be one of Apple's longest running designs.
Designs. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, and plus when you figure that the laptop market is
growing.
Exploding.
Absolutely.
You know, so much faster than the desktops.
I think Apple said that was, 60% of their Mac sales? The last quarter was PowerBook.
Yeah, it was laptops.
Laptops, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, they just updated the MacBooks, but really that was just a speed bump.
Hmm. Well, flat panels are really coming down on price.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Steve Jobs even said that the next round of MacBook Pros will have LED backlighting, or I'm sorry, will have, was it LED See, now I'm...
Well, it's just backlighting.
No, they will have a certain type of backlighting. Yeah, as LED, which will make them much more brighter, much more crisper. You can get a lot more mm-hmm. out of your screen than you can now. Some PC vendors already use that. And
yeah.
From what I understand, it really does make a difference. So I think you're right, Guy. I think you're going to see some new... What would you like to see in a new MacBook Pro?
24 one here inch. At my house.
You know, here's the thing, though. I've got a MacBook Pro. I had it at the Macworld Expo last year.
Right.
And I've had it now. It's been over a year, hasn't it, Chad?
Yep.
Yeah, that was a first gen, wasn't
the
it?
The first gen, mm-hmm. yes. And quite honestly, I'm still very happy with it. It doesn't feel sluggish at all to me.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to have a little bit of a faster one, but honestly, unless it's significantly faster, I just don't see the point.
Right.
And I have yet to have a problem with this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not one problem. And the same thing goes for the PowerBook G4 that I replaced it with. I never had a problem with that. Mm-hmm. So I think Apple is really doing extremely well on their laptops. Yeah, you're going to hear the horror stories online.
Oh yeah,
but I mean, you know.
It's a mass produced product, and any time that the production of something is in, you know, when it's counted in units of thousands, you're going to have some that could get past quality control that aren't quite up to snuff.
Guy Soro wrote up our show notes, mm-hmm. i.e. our news stories for this week. And the next one, Guy, you put the death of the Mini. What's going on with that?
I just heard some rumors that along with the Mini, that they're talking about eliminating the 17-inch iMacs as well. And that kind of confused me because those are like the two big education market units. So does that mean that there's something new coming that is going to kind of fill that low-end slot?
I don't know. What's your prediction, Chad? Do you think the Mac Mini's on its way out, or...?
Boy.
I know Apple likes having that price point for an entry-level computer for PC switchers.
If they see most of their growth being in the laptop area...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the sense
in
having
those people are gonna they're gonna go to MacBooks.
You think with the price of everything coming down, screens, batteries, mm-hmm. RAM, the prices are dropping, do you think we're going to see an even lower entry point MacBook in any time in the future? That could theoretically take the place of the Mac Mini.
I could see that happening, like a 12-inch
$799 MacBook. Yeah. Would that be interest to you, Guy?
Well, sure. They could basically take the motherboard from the MacBook and put it in a pizza box. If you know, for the people that know what I'm talking about, talking about the old cases for the LC and LC2s, and you know it's really a better form factor, especially for people that might want to also consider using it for like a home entertainment network. It just they need something else, and they need to get a full size drive in it. The Mac Mini is kind of, I think may have kind of just served its purpose, and now it's time to replace it with something new. Of course, what I really want is a Core 2 Duo Mini Tower
mm-hmm.
with some expansion capability.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what about this one right this story right here with Steve Jobs believes Al Gore would win the U.S. presidency if he ran?
Yeah.
Is he just saying that because Al's on the board?
Yeah, I gotta wonder about that.
Yeah.
No. Well, I mean, Steve Jobs is he's been a Democrat for a long time, and I don't think Al Gore would be on the board if he didn't like him and didn't agree with a lot of his policies.
And you know, if he didn't invent mm-hmm. the internet.
Yeah, well, that helps. Might want to talk to Senator Stevens. His tubes are full.
Yeah. I think it's a nice thing to say. Quite honestly, politics is probably the most boring subject we can cover on this podcast for most of our listeners. I mean, let's be honest. The majority of our listeners are from the United States. But mm-hmm. I would say that's, by looking at the stats on our log, that's probably about 60% of everybody who listens to this website or mm-hmm. listens to this podcast is in the continental United States. The other 40% are from the world.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got people listening from Australia and you name it.
Right.
You know. So what do they care about what Steve Jobs says about Al Gore or but
the next president?
But wouldn't it be nice to have a president that was a board member of Apple Computer?
I think he'd probably have to no longer be a board member of Apple.
No, yeah. but coming from that background, though, what kind of policies could he put in place to maybe give Apple a little boost up in government?
Working for a government agency, I know I wouldn't mind suddenly seeing the piece of crap Dell that sits at my desk disappear for some kind of Mac.
But you got to admit, though, those Dell monitors are pretty nice. I don't know about the one you have, but you know, I've been looking.
19-inch. It's okay.
If I was going to buy a new monitor right now to replace my 23-inch cinema display, I think it would probably be the 24-inch Dell.
Yeah.
I'm serious. It's got ports on it, so I can plug stuff into it, including a card reader.
Yeah.
I mean, how great would that be? I think they're...
Now, but at the same time, I'm seeing 22-inch monitors for under $300.
That's true. Absolutely. But it's not just the size of the monitor. You got to see what resolution that it can use as well.
That's true.
But no, you know, I was pricing out a Mac system, the place that I freelance. One of the ladies is moving to a credit union where she's going to be in charge of all the advertising. And they told her they knew she was a Mac user, so they were going to get her an entire Mac setup.
Wow.
And for her to tell them what she wants. So she turned to me and said, well,
holy cow.
What should I get? What software should I get? Which Mac system? So I put together a nice price quote for her. And she wants a side cart monitor. For those who don't know, that means you have your main monitor, then you have a smaller monitor to the left or right of it that holds stuff like your palettes and Illustrator, Photoshop, and that sort of thing. So you just have a lot more screen real estate to play with. Both monitors were Dell. One was a $399 22-inch for the side cart, and the main monitor was, I think we went with a 24 or a 30-inch Dell. And putting those two together was only a little bit more than one Apple Cinema display.
Wow.
So Apple really needs to come down on the price of those displays, or, and because, you know, we've been talking about, you know, the MacBook Pro needs to be upgraded. I think the Cinema display lines needs to be upgraded big time.
Well, how many of those do they actually sell?
Oh, I'm sure quite a few. If I go into a professional studio that has nothing but Macs, it's always Apple monitors. Very rarely do I see a Dell or a, you know, anything like that. Yeah, maybe as a side cart monitor, but the main monitors are almost always Apple displays.
Apple. Well, how much quality is there? Quality difference is there between, say, a 23-inch Apple Cinema display and a Dell 22 or 24?
I don't think there's any.
No.
I honestly.
And it's what, half the cost?
Half the cost. And
well, I think David Cohn reviewed one of the first 22-inch Dells.
Yeah.
And he gave it very high marks. Yeah. He went out and bought one, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, absolutely. They're nice monitors. But let's be honest, Apple doesn't make those monitors. The company that makes it is probably making the Dell monitors, too. And, you know, why spend so much money just because it has the Apple brand on it?
Yeah.
If Apple wants my money for a monitor, they better offer me more than what I can get for cheaper and as an equal quality with a competing vendor. You know what I mean? If I can get a Dell 24 for $400 less than an Apple 24 or 23, plus I get all these other options with it, you know, a card reader built in and this, that, and the
USB
other.
USB ports and everything else.
Well, the Apple monitors has USB port too, but they're not convenient. They're behind it.
Good Lord, I know.
And it's a pain in the butt. I think Apple really needs to take a look at their product line and monitors and make some drastic changes.
Or decide whether they want to continue to compete in that.
Yeah, exactly. If they're not really, if they can be competitive, why not put Dell monitors right there on the Apple website to order? I'm sure Dell wouldn't mind.
Right. Yeah.
and if they're of equal quality, I don't think Mac users would care. I mean, there's going to be some hardcore Mac users. I'm not going to have a Dell anything on my desktop.
Well, whatever.
I'm not type of person. I'm going to go with the product that I can afford and that's going to get the job done for me. The computer's always going to be an Apple Macintosh.
Right.
Don't make any mistake about that. I'm not about to put a Dell laptop or or desktop anywhere near me if I can help it. But everything else is up for grabs. My keyboard, my mouse, my monitor, my eyesight camera.
Peripherals are peripherals.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly. What's going on with the eyesight cameras? They're like extinct now. You think that's going to be something they're going to build into the new monitors?
Oh, yeah.
I think they pretty much have to.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, the IMAX and all the laptops already have built-in webcams. So, you know, why not go that last little step and put it onto the monitors as well?
So, as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, iTunes was updated, iTunes Plus. This is the long-awaited DRM-free, at least for, you know, 5% of the music they sell on there right now. The EMI music.
Right.
Paul McCartney and Pink Floyd.
And kudos to EMI.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. They're pioneers. Yay. They're pioneers, they're visionaries, and they want to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. and I think the writing was on the wall for a while that the DRM just is not working. It's not furthering the growth of online digital music sales. It's just not.
And it's not helping their CD sales either.
No, absolutely. So the new version of comes out, I talk about this with the interview with Chris Breen. I had one EMI sound guy.
I had five.
Did you? It cost me a total of 30 cents to upgrade. I was kind of disappointed.
$1.50.
Not that I want to sit there and spend, you know, 30 or 40 bucks to upgrade my music library, but I was hoping that more of the music that I own was upgradable because I do want a better quality. And somebody was asking me, I was chatting with someone the other night, and I really don't remember who it was at this point, and they asked me, well, why do you want a DRM-free version if you already have or the DRM? I mean, what's the difference? What are you going to use it for? And immediately I said, well, you know, I listen to my iTunes library via Kinect 360 on my Xbox 360 when I'm playing games. I can log in on the... I don't do anything on the Mac. I bought a piece of software, I think it costs 20 bucks, Kinect 360... And or maybe they gave it to me for review. I forget now. I think I bought it though. And it shares my music library and my photos over the network with my Xbox 360. So I'm sitting there playing
with
games.
With the exception of
DRM, yeah. Right? So all the music that I just bought, like the new Linkin Park. Mm-hmm. Well, there was Linkin Park. I bought that last week, and it's a good album. I really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Not for kids. And it's rocking music, and I'm like, this is cool. This would be great to listen to as I'm, you know, blowing people up in whatever game I happen to be playing. But I can't, because it's DRM.
Right.
That's BS. I bought that music.
In order to do it, you've got to do the old MP3 swaparoo.
Right. I got to burn a CD and then re-import. But I'm not going to do that, because now I've got two versions of the same music.
Taking up your hard drive space.
Exactly. Yeah. Not that hard drive space is really a problem for me. But I kind of like to keep it a little bit neat and tidy.
Yeah.
It's just BS. Why should I have to run through... Why should I have to jump through hoops to listen to the music I own simply because I want to listen to it on my Xbox? It's not like I'm ripping it to the Xbox.
And the Xbox is capable of playing AAC.
Oh, absolutely. Songs. Well, it does. Absolutely. And it just drives me crazy. So I'm listening to stuff that, you know, I've listened to 1,000 times, but I can't listen to my new music. It sucks.
Mm-hmm.
So... The writing is on the wall for DRM free music, and I hope Apple comes to an agreement and a consensus with the other music companies, because I am willing to pay more money for my own music so I can use it the way that I think that it was always intended to be used, however I want.
Did you have any problems downloading iTunes 7.2?
No. You know, Chris Breen was talking about, and again, we're doing this in reverse order, but Chris Breen was talking about that a lot of people ran into problems because it was so busy. I must have hit it at a sweet spot because it was downloaded at no problem, upgraded my one song. it does make you agree to a new EULA, user agreement, because it's DRM-free music. Mm-hmm. So you go, okay, I agree. I'm not going to share it.
But the thing is, what a lot of people might not
know... I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, what a lot of people might not know is that your username and email address that you used when you first logged into the iTunes store
is
embedded into the song. So if you take this AAC file or AAC encased music file and upload that to a torrent site, well, if the RIAA gets a hold of it, they've got your name, they've got your email address, and you're basically screwed.
Right, and honestly, I don't have a problem with that because it's not about sharing music is why I want DRM-free music. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the reason I just gave. I want to be able to use my music
wherever I want,
whether that's in another video that I'm creating for myself, listening to it on the Xbox, or even, heaven forbid, I buy a Zune and I want to put that music on a Zune.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Why shouldn't I be able to do that? Right. So anyway, so iTunes was updated free of charge. QuickTime went through an update as well. And what was the other big? There's two other updates. We'll get to the Apple TV in a second.
Oh, there was a security update.
Right. Oh, there was a lot of problems I heard that people were having with that. That after they upgraded to the new security update, their machines were basically hanging. They weren't restarting correctly.
I didn't have.
I've done it on a iBook 933 G4, and I've done it on my 24-inch iMac, and I didn't have a problem with either one.
I've done it on the MacBook. We did it on my wife's iBook.
Any problems?
No problems. It does take a while longer than normal to restart.
Only the first time, though.
Only the first time.
And so then after that, subsequently after that, it's reboots.
Fine. But yeah, if you're used to, like, okay, you know, usually I'll go through the restart and then bam, bam, and back up again.
Right.
You have to wait through this one. And it takes about, oh, probably about 15 to 20 seconds, which seems like an eternity.
That
now
seems to 15 to 20 minutes, right? Yeah.
Well, now see, I didn't have that problem with this one. I had that with the last one.
I think everybody. It's depending on your configuration, mm-hmm. and I think the more memory, more RAM you have, the longer it's probably going to take. You know, what's funny is that, as you said, Chad, you're used to restarting now, and it's bam, bam, you're back up and running. Mm-hmm. I broke out the old Lombard PowerBook and started it up, and I thought it was broken or something. It took so long for it to boot up. So I thought, I better restart this just to make sure. And it took forever again. And then I thought, oh, yeah, this is an old machine. 10.3.
Oh, okay.
Or
wow, 10.3 on a laptop that was made in, what, 99?
Right. And it's 10.3.3, or 10.3.9.
Well, speaking of old laptops, we do have some reader feedback that we need to respond to.
Yep, let's jump into that before we finish up the news. And so this is an long-time listener now.
Yeah, Ivan Marshall.
Ivan Marshall, and let's listen to Ivan's real quick.
Hi, this is Ivan Marshall. I'm calling and want to relay again how great your guys' podcast is. But I had a couple of questions concerning Apple Portables. I have a Pismo PowerBook that I'm crazy about, never had an ounce of trouble out of. I'm running Tiger, and it has all the attachments that only it has. Never had an AirPort problem, so I'm very satisfied. But the machine is old, and I'm thinking about the MacBook Pro. But I'm hearing about bad battery problems and swelling, sudden shutdowns, latch problems, and things like that. And then WWDC is right around the corner, where new machines are most likely going to be introduced. So do you recommend that I wait until the new machines are introduced, maybe the refurb prices for MacBook Pros will go down, and then buy one then, or wait until they get these bad MacBook Pros out of the systems with the battery problems and maybe let the new one go into the refurb system before I buy? I was kind of afraid about trying a brand new model, but when I tried the brand new iMac Intel, I was fabulously happy with it. It's a super fast machine. I never had an ounce of trouble out of it. So I'm just wondering what you think about quality problems and whether you would recommend a MacBook Pro. Thank you. Have a good one.
Thanks very much, Ivan. All right, let's take the first part of that. Should he upgrade to a MacBook or MacBook Pro based solely on the quality issues that you read about online?
I don't think he should wait as far as that goes.
It's something that we were just talking about, that something that's such a mass-produced item.
Right.
You're gonna get some lemons in there occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've never had a problem taking a machine back to an Apple store or contacting Apple and getting very, very good service.
And I know Ivan's a lot closer to an Apple store than we are.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me.
I have to agree with Guy. I think that from a quality standpoint, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with the MacBook or the MacBook Pro line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're going to see horror stories. I mean,
sure.
It's the internet.
Yeah.
If someone stubs their toe on their new Mac, they're
right.
going to report that
using GarageBand, so therefore
right.
GarageBand sucks.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen the swelling battery problem, but I've only seen it reported on a few websites, and it's the same picture. So has it happened? I'm sure it has. Has it happened more than 100 times? I don't know. I think that if it was such a big problem, Apple would recall it. Apple's recalled batteries already in the past.
Sure.
Well, yeah, they're not shy.
Yeah.
Apple's not shy about recalling stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think if this was a quality control issue that Apple was having with these batteries, you would have seen mass recalls by now.
Mm-hmm.
And because it has happened in the past, I think if you were to buy one now, it's probably a problem that Apple has already addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So from a quality standpoint, I don't think that I would be at all hesitant to buy a new MacBook or MacBook Pro. Now, the second part of that question is, and by the way, Ivan, it will be so much faster than your Pismo.
Oh,
it will simply blow your mind.
Yeah, if you were happy with your Intel iMac, you'll be equally happy with an Intel iBook.
Going from MacBook a Pismo MacBook, that you're used to taking with you.
Which is, what, a 400 or 500 megahertz G3.
Yeah, that's probably a 500 megahertz G3.
Mm-hmm.
And going to a 2.1 gigahertz Intel chip.
Two core.
Yeah, it's going to be so fast, it's going to blow your mind. You'll be like, oh, holy moly. It will actually seem faster than the iMac at first, mm-hmm. simply because it's basically the same form factor that you're used to with your old machine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a laptop, the screen sizes are roughly the same, and it's got the keyboard, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's the same form factor. So that speed jump is just going to be so wow.
Yeah,
that you're going to be extremely pleased. Now, but the second part of that question is: should he be buying now, or should he wait for another few months until WWDC is over? When's WWDC again?
It's in like mid June.
Mid June, mm-hmm. Is it mid June? Is it really?
Yeah.
Let's Chad. Why don't you look that up to make sure not in the notes?
June 20th, I believe, is the date that I'm hearing that they're supposed to release the iPhone.
Well, even if it was, yeah, I think you're right. Even if it was July 20th, we're in within a six week period before Apple has some big announcements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a firm believer that if you need something now, buy it now. You're always going to have buyer remorse. It's never ever going to change.
Yeah.
By the same token, if you can hold on, which I think you can, Ivan, for just a couple more weeks to see what happens at WWDC. I think that we are, in fact, going to see some new laptops. At the very least, a speed bump.
And then the question to you becomes, do I go with the latest, or do, like you were saying, do I wait for a refurbished or a price reduced?
Of the ones that are out there current.
Yeah.
It depends on what the savings are going to be. The current ones are fabulous machines. I mean, I've got the first generation MacBook Pro. They're on the second generation now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm extremely happy with mine.
And I've got a first-gen MacBook, and I'm very happy with it.
So I don't think you'd be disappointed. If you could pick up my machine for under $1,700, I think it would be well worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And mine's a 15-inch MacBook Pro with, 2.5 gigs of RAM. I forget what it is now. I've never had a problem with it. Will I? I'm sure I will eventually. I use it all the darn time. I use it more than this is saying something for me. I use it, my MacBook 15-inch MacBook Pro, more than I use my desktop G5 with a 23-inch monitor with a 19-inch sidecar.
And I would say the same with my MacBook 13.3-inch monitor screen.
You're sitting here next to a G5 with a 23-inch monitor.
Yep.
And you're using the laptop with less screen real estate that's slower.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why do we do that?
Convenience. The ability to take it down, in our case, to the family room, which is in the basement.
Yeah.
Get online when my wife is watching something I'm not interested in watching.
Putting on the headphones.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I use my MacBook Pro in the kitchen. And I will say, however, that when I need to do some serious graphic work...
you've got to go to the desktop.
I got to go to the desktop because I need the screen real estate. But how difficult would it be for me to simply plug that monitor into the MacBook Pro? It'd be easy. I could do that.
Sure.
No problem at all. And it's fast enough to run any graphic program that the G5 is running. No sweat.
Mm-hmm.
I've been debating this lately on my next major Mac purchase, whether I go with an upgraded MacBook Pro.
Like a 17-inch?
Yeah. And I don't get another big desktop.
I think you'd miss it.
I think I would, too. But I'm stuck there. I don't know. I really don't. I'm so used to having a desktop. Because a desktop, to me, screams serious work.
Right.
The laptop screams disposable.
Kind of
Yeah, but you know, it's almost to the point now where the difference between the desktop and a laptop is the difference between a car and a truck.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
They serve the same function, but I mean, there are times where, yeah,
you could fit
a
little bit more in the back of a truck.
Yeah.
Same with the desktop. You could fit more RAM in it,
yeah.
Or you can fit more hard drives in there.
Mm-hmm.
And you just can't go through the mud with an Apple laptop.
Right. But how often do you really need the truck?
Right.
You know, 95% of the time, you're not hauling anything. Mm-hmm. You don't have a big pile of whatever in the back of the pickup truck. Mm-hmm. You're just driving to the grocery store.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a good analogy. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I'm here at the Apple store right now, and they have a refurbed. The only thing they have in the way of MacBook Pros is a 17-inch 2.33 for $22.99.
I bet if you check out Small Dog Electronics, they're not advertising here anymore, unfortunately. We miss you, Small Dog. But I'm so good.
They
do great refurbs. And so, and they have really good pricing.
And great support.
Yep. So if you're looking in the refurb market to Ivan, after Apple makes their announcements at the WWDC, and you want to save some money, I would say go check out Small Dog Electronics. Mm-hmm. Make sure you tell them my message. The last news story tonight, and I think this is kind of a big deal, is the Apple TV was upgraded today. Today being Thursday. Actually, mm-hmm. I think it happened yesterday. Up to this point, they were coming with, what was it, a 40 gig in it?
Yeah, 40 gig drive.
Now it's 160 gig. That's a...
For only $100 more.
Yeah, $399, 160 gigabyte. And not only that, Viacom is claiming to welcome the opportunity to license its content to Apple.
At the same time that they're suing
MTV
Google.
And, yeah. And not to mention the next version, I don't know if they've upgraded it yet, I think it's still a week away or so, is Apple is going to include YouTube as part of the Apple TV. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work. I'm kind of curious.
Mm-hmm.
How do you type in what you're looking for?
If you're going to watch...
a good point.
YouTube video on a high-definition television, expect it to be not quite HD quality.
Well, the reason that they didn't run it and do it immediately, did you know that Google, i.e. YouTube, is upgrading all of their videos to H.264.
Mm.
They're upgrading everything. Is it 264?
I think it's 264.
It's late at night, and I'm kind of getting a little punchy. they're upgrading everything, so anything you upgrade to Google Video right now will be that format.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be better quality. And I welcome that. But again, crap in is crap out.
Right.
You know, if it's a cell phone video that someone uploaded, I don't care how what mm-hmm. codec you're going to use to encode that video. It's still going to be a cell phone video.
Yep.
But the whole point to me of YouTube is to go on there and not to click whatever video happens to be on the front page and then start finding stuff that mm-hmm. way. It's to type in what you're looking for.
Yep.
And how do you do that on the Apple TV? I don't know. It doesn't come with a keyboard. Do you think it would be cool for Apple to support kind of a virtual keyboard? So if you hit like the up and down while you're at YouTube mm-hmm. on the Apple TV, it brings up a little keyboard.
Probably,
and
it'd still be a bear to have to search all those to type in what you're doing.
Well, what if a little a mouse came up, a cursor,
mm-hmm.
that as you move the Apple remote, it's moving that little cursor. So you just point to a letter, click enter. Yeah, I like that.
Well, the other thing it could do is
that would be
you can subscribe to different people's downloads or uploads.
Yeah, but that's still pretty limited.
What you can do is if you're on your computer and you have those saved, you could have those categories of either, you know, types of videos you're looking for or content from people that you enjoy looking at.
If you're a registered user of YouTube, but how does that work if you're using an Apple TV? It's not reading your YouTube preferences on your computer.
No, that's true.
So we're back to the how useful is YouTube on Apple TV? Is it going to be a kind of a best of YouTube that is kind of force-fed to us?
And you've just got a thumb
whatever someone at Apple or Google decided to put on the Apple TV YouTube feed is what you have to look at.
But that's not how people use YouTube.
No.
YouTube is always one of those, here's the link to this cool video, or do a search for this video and this cool, and you'll see the video I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we talk about it here.
Exactly. You do a search for it.
Yeah.
And that's how, I don't see how Google is going to benefit, or Apple is going to benefit for having YouTube integration without a keyboard. We need an input device to tell YouTube what we're looking for. I want to find the Mentos Coke.
Yeah.
And boom, there's a whole bunch of them. Now I could watch those. But if we're just force-fed, it's just another crappy channel that no one's ever going to watch. Occasionally you'll go to, especially when you first get the Apple TV. But eventually you won't use it for that, because if you want to find something on YouTube, you go sit down in front of the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea of a virtual keyboard, which really would just be a software upgrade for the Apple TV, I think that would probably work the best.
Yeah.
So somebody get on Steve Jobs on that.
We'll see if we right can. Away.
Get on there, please.
Tell them to listen to the podcast.
That's right. So that was news for this week. And we want to thank again Audible.com, if you can hear it.
It's Audible.
For
sponsoring,
yeah.
And the website for the last month.
We need to jump into the interview with Chris Breen that Chad and I did earlier. Thanks a lot for coming on with this guy.
Oh, no problem. I love doing it.
Anybody have any conflicting thing on their schedule next week, or are we all here again next week?
Should all be here.
Yep. Nothing cool. I can think of off the top of my head. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but...
If you, the listener, wants to send in some comments like Ivan did, all you have to do is call our telephone number, which is...
1-801-938-5559.
Or go up to mymac.com, and it's going to be right there. Just
yep.
Look at any of the podcast postings, and we've got it listed there. Well, I guess I should probably say good night, Gracie. And we're here with Macworld's Chris Breen. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So, you know, I bet most of the podcasts that you get on, you're always talking about Apple gear and the latest Mac stuff and so on and so forth, correct?
Right.
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
No. Okay, good. Let's talk about the Zune, shall we?
Actually, we wanted to go back in time a little bit and find out how you got involved with writing as well as covering Apple and the Macintosh and when and how and all the fun stuff. So let's start at writing. How did you become a writer?
It was dumb luck. I was a musician at the time, and I had a Macintosh Plus, which tells you how long ago this was. And my girlfriend at the time was working at Mac User Magazine. As a working musician, I was using my Mac Plus with MIDI gear. I was using Mark of the Unicorns Performer, which is like Performer 1.0 at the time. And an editor was standing outside of her cube, and he said, I have these three MIDI utilities that we need to have covered in news. And we have no idea what MIDI is. We have no idea who can write about this stuff. And we're desperate. And my girlfriend sort of put up her hand tentatively and said, well, my boyfriend uses that stuff, and he uses his Mac, and maybe he could do it. And the editor said, so can he write? And she replied, well, he wrote for his high school newspaper.
Which really is all the qualifications you usually need.
Exactly. Great on your resume. And he was so desperate that he said, okay, I'll give him a chance. And so she brought home the software. I stayed up all night. I wrote the three news pieces. And he liked what I did. And from there, I just started getting more and more work until I am where I am today.
Now, it's not just Macworld, though. You wrote for Mac User and Mac Week as well, correct?
Yeah, when I started out, I was a freelancer for Mac User, and I eventually became a contributing editor there, which is sort of a highfalutin title for a freelance writer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when Mac User and Macworld merged, I remained a contributing editor for Macworld, and I really didn't become an employee of Macworld until about a year and a half ago.
Wow. Were you doing other writing gigs at the same time, or was your focus on the Mac?
It was almost entirely on the Mac. I've done some outside writing. I've actually written for a magazine called iNet, which is for ophthalmologists.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, and I know absolutely nothing about ophthalmology.
Well, that's all right. I've been writing mymac.com for 12 years now, and I don't really know Macs that well. So.
Well, there you go. So, here's
a few people know that.
Yeah, few people know that.
Here's a general recommendation, though. If you walk into your eye doctor's office and you see a copy of iNet magazine, run away, because he's been reading my stuff and maybe following some of those procedures, and they're dangerous, each and every one.
They approach you, and you saw iNet, and you thought, well, it's got an I in it. I can write about that.
Exactly.
What's Jobs up to now?
It was just one of those funny things. It was an editor of mine who had been a Mac user, and she'd gone on to run this thing. And actually, there was some computer-related stuff that they wanted to do for the magazine, and she thought of me. And so generally, if I've written outside of the Mac industry or the Apple industry, it's because an editor of mine has gone somewhere else and said, oh, we need somebody reliable who works cheap, and so we'll get Chris to do this.
Nothing like being known as reliable and cheap.
Yeah, I mean, that really, you know, for all of you would-be writers out there, that's the way to make your mark, is reliable and work cheap. But given that now there's the web, everybody's working cheap.
And, yeah.
And if you have to blog every day, you're reliable.
Yeah.
So did you catch any of the D conference this past week? And did you watch the videos with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates up on stage?
I didn't watch the videos. Macworld was blogging the thing live. Jason Snell, who's our editorial director, was doing it. So I followed the live blog, and I kind of read the highlights of the things, and some of the comments were great. I thought it was interesting that the Jobs and Gates were very nice to each other. You know, they sort of played the grand old men of the technology business, and they didn't have to take shots at each other. And although I understand that Gates was a little bit miffed about the Mac versus PC commercials.
Yeah, he didn't seem very happy about that. And when Steve Jobs interrupted him towards the very beginning to tell a Steve Wozniak story, Gates kind of had this little bit of a miffed look about him, like, oh, fine, whatever.
Yeah. It was that look of, I'm about to be hit in the face with a pie.
Well, you know, I was actually reading Jason's coverage of it as he was live blogging it, and I came back and read the whole thing again. I thought, oh, I don't really need to watch it now because I read it. But then I actually did start. I'm about halfway part three right now, and there's seven parts, so it's quite long. And you really get more out of it by watching it than just reading it. It's really interesting to see the difference between these two guys. One seems extremely confident about his ability and his company, and the other one seems a little almost nervous, like, boy, I hope they don't ask me any really difficult questions that I'm going to have to answer for.
Well, I think that's also part of Gates' demeanor. You know, he's not really a showman. He really is a Revenge of the Nerds kind of guy, you know, and if the two of them were in a, you know, Revenge of the Nerds 6, Jobs would kick sand in his face, just because Gates is that kind of nerd, not
that's true,
because he's more of a towering intellect. But also, Gates is really, you know, he's kind of moving away from Microsoft. He's interested in his foundation work, which is brilliant. You know, I mean, it's wonderful that he's doing that kind of stuff. And Jobs really is very much still on the move in terms of Pixar and Disney and Apple. So I think that may explain part of the, you know, the sort of dynamism of Jobs and maybe the more laid-back character of Gates.
Let me jump ahead to a little bit of more current events. A while back, Editor-in-Chief Harry McCracken of PC World quit. And there was a lot of talk about, well, it was because an ex-Macworld person was in charge now, and he was trying to squash any anti-Apple articles at PC World, which some people believed. I personally didn't. But then it started coming out that, well, you know, at Macworld, Apple can just pretty much squash anything like that, and that Macworld is really in the pocket of Apple. I personally didn't believe that, but what's your response to that, those allegations that came out?
I thought that was interesting, yeah. When Harry walked out, I don't know Harry well. I've met him a couple of times, and we get along. And I know Colin Crawford, who was
the CEO.
The CEO at the time, and Colin and I have worked together for a number of years. And so I just was sort of watching it from the outside, and suddenly Macworld got swept into this thing sort of through innuendo. It's like, wait a minute, we had nothing to do with this. You know, we're just doing our jobs here. I thought it was interesting that, and it may be just the cynical nature of today, how people view the media. I mean, when I look at the mainstream media, largely about politics, and I sort of see stories that are written a certain way, I'm just like everybody else. I say, ah, they're on the take, or they're getting dinner with this guy, or there's some kind of undue influence happening here. But when you're on the receiving end of it, and people are implying that you're on the take, or that Apple can call any one of us at any time and say, you must not publish that story. You must do this or do that. It's annoying because it's absolutely not true. You know, I would see comments where people say, oh, well, you know, obviously they're writing positive reviews because these people advertise with them or something else. I work very much on my own, as do a lot of the writers. I have no idea who's advertising with us, nor do I care who's advertising with us. Every so often at a Macworld Expo, a vendor will come up and say, oh, I advertise with you. You know, like, so?
Yeah.
You know, I don't care. And I mean, I don't mean to be rude to people, but that's my job, is to not care who advertises with us. And Apple is just another company, as far as I'm concerned. Fortunately, I have enough knowledge and experience with the company to understand their products pretty well. And Apple has been making some really good stuff for a number of years. And so, yeah, you don't see us kick Apple's products around very much because they haven't produced a product that's really lousy. The Cube is the last one that really comes to mind, or the Round Mouse or something. So Apple has its problems occasionally, but, you know, the idea that Apple calls anybody at Macworld and says, you have to do this, is, you know, it's simply not true. They may put pressure on the CEO, I don't know, but the pressure would stay there and not trickle down to anybody on staff.
As it should. And I think the people that were probably making that accusation are those probably PC users that never read Macworld to begin with, because I've read many a critical of Apple articles in Macworld, and I found it pretty much unfounded. I was like, well, these people obviously are not reading Macworld, because you're not Apple's best friend, and I don't think that you guys would be the success that you have been over this many years if you were simply in Apple's back pocket. People expect to hear critical articles or read critical articles. I don't think you guys have ever really disappointed in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we certainly try not to, but you know, I understand that people, you know, they have all kinds of reasons for being unhappy. I read one thread where I recognized somebody who had been a forum visitor in our forums, and we had to boot him out because they were so obnoxious. This guy had an axe to grind, and so he went in and he made disparaging comments about the magazine, hinting that we were on the take. And it's like, no, it's because you were a jerk and we tossed you out of our forums. Sorry. You know, so you read the stuff and you just have to take it with a grain of salt. So, some people either they're not familiar with the magazine, or they're unhappy about something we've done in the past, or it's personal, you know, so you just sort of say, okay, that's your opinion, and most people appreciate what we do, and a few don't, and that's just the way the world works.
For those who are looking to become a writer, you pretty much have to grow a thick skin. Do you think that's more true now with the age of the internet with instant feedback, or do you think it's more of a dialogue between your readers than it ever was before?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Yeah, you have to have more or less a thick skin, because when you're posting on the web and stuff comes out immediately, they have their comment sections in their forums, and I think that's good. It's a wonderful thing that readers have contact with the people who are providing that content. But every so often, people have a hard time, and they can get really personal about it. And I found that the best solution for that, if I get either email or on a forum, is speak directly back to that person, and invariably they're shocked that you are a real person.
Mm-hmm. I've got that before.
If I reply to somebody in a polite way and say, okay, I understand you have this problem, this is why I wrote whatever I did, and this is how I came to those conclusions, and more often than not, they'll say, oh, gee, I didn't think you'd actually read this. Well, you said it to me, so...
Yeah,
I did read it, and of course, I care about what I write, and I try to make it as accurate as possible, and I want people to learn something, and get something out of what I write. So if somebody's unhappy, I do want to read about it and figure out why, and if it's something I can address, I'll try to. And if they're just upset because they're upset, then that's too bad.
I've had people ask me this question, and my answer surprisingly was no, and it kind of surprised me when I really thought about it, but would you want to work for Apple Computer? Well, Apple Incorporated now, I'm sorry. I'll never get used to that, by the way. It'll always be Apple Computer Incorporated to me, but... if you could work for Apple, would you want to?
Well, let me describe my current job. I commute downstairs. I occasionally get dressed before 3 p.m. I eat
showers
whenever
every other Wednesday.
I want to. Yeah, I mean, I get to go up and see my daughter. I get to write about Macs and play with really cool stuff. So I have the best job on earth. The idea of then driving over the hill to work at Apple and working 6-7 days a week sometimes, which I do here, but at least I'm home, is not that appealing to me. I think Apple does wonderful work, but I know they run lean. Those guys work really, really hard. I think the stuff that they do is very interesting, and there may come a time in my life where I'd want to do that, but I don't have sort of that dewy-eyed view of Apple that is, oh, it would be like going to Oz, because it's not. It's like going to another company where you'd get to do cool stuff, but you work really, really hard.
I don't think it's any how could I put this? Most of the people that I see that work for Apple are young guys or young women. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that people burn out working for a company like Apple, and new people come in, and the older people move on to less demanding jobs.
Yeah, I think that's the case, and that's the case of a lot of companies in Silicon Valley. With whether you go to HP or Intel or some of the other ones, a lot of the people that work there are young, because it's that kind of thing. And or particularly if you're doing startups, you know, when eBay started, everybody was young, and they all worked a jillion hours, and now, of course, they're all retired. But that's the kind of people you need to do some of these high-stress jobs, because by the time you get into your 40s or late 30s, you've got a family, you want to spend time with them. You don't want to be working all the time.
If you can go back in time with two pieces of equipment and meet the two Steves when they were first starting Apple in that garage, what would the two pieces of equipment be? What would you take back and show them what the company eventually creates? Or would you even want to do that?
I think I would have been afraid of Steve Jobs even then.
You think so?
Even if I was old enough to be his father, I think I would still be intimidated by the guy. I'd take back the iPod. I'd take back the newest, coolest iPod that they had, and I'd say, look at this. I know you guys didn't invent it, but someday you're going to sell one, and you're going to be looked upon as a rock star because you did. What other gear would I show them?
It doesn't even let's not even say it's an Apple product. If you could take the iPod was one, but then something else that's not Macintosh related. Is there one thing that you would love to show visionaries like that 30 years ago?
I'm gazing around my office at all the cool stuff that I have in here, and I'm wondering what it might be.
He'd bring back the Xbox 360 and tell Steve, you're going to invent something called the Pippin. Stick with it.
Don't bother. What I think I would do is, along those lines, I think I would take my Newton 2100 back.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you still regret Steve axing the Newton project?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure that Apple had the right attitude about that in the first place. I remember interviewing a guy, this is a couple of years after the Newton was killed, and I had my 2100 with me, and I was interviewing him, and I was taking notes on my Newton, and he said, oh, you know, I used to be the product manager for that. Oh, really? Well, here it is. Could, you know, autograph it. And he said, well, I just wish you'd bought more of those things. And my thinking was, I wish you'd marketed it better.
Yeah,
and maybe more people would have, because you guys, I mean, at that time, it was like, well, look what Palm's doing. Those are your old people, and they're doing very well at this time, and you guys just blew it. So, yes, Steve killed it, but it wasn't doing well at the time. It would have been interesting to see what had happened if they'd kept going with it, but I think they just weren't looking at it the right way. So maybe it's just as well that it died and went off to Palmland.
What's Chris Breen's favorite non-Apple, non-Macintosh gadget right now?
My piano.
Is it really?
Yeah. I have a Homburg Steinway, which is, for people who know pianos, that would elicit an ooh.
Mm-hmm.
And people who don't, the difference is that the New York's, there are two Steinways, New York and German. And the New York ones are made in a factory, and they're very nice, but the German ones are like handmade, and they feel so great. They just play beautifully, so, and they're nice and bright. So yeah, it's my piano. It's a Steinway O, for those people who know, which isn't enormous, but it just really does everything I want, and I could give up every machine I own and keep that one thing, and I'd be happy.
I have a light blue shirt that says, I think it's Circus du Mac, that is proof that Chris Breen still plays music to this day.
Oh, that's right, the Cirque du Mac. Yeah,
Cirque du Mac.
Yeah, you guys are really good. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, that's probably the majority of our listeners right now. During the Macworld Expo, you get together with some other Mac users, Brian Chafin. I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, Brian Chafin, Bob Levitis, yeah. Paul Kent, Bob. Who runs Macworld Expo,
yep.
Dave Hamilton, who's
yep.
with the Mac Observer, and that's my phone.
If that's for me, I'm not here.
Okay. It's going to ring four times before it does something, so you want to stop and edit?
Nah, we're good.
Okay. All right. Then we won't. I'll just turn this down.
Shut up!
I'm trying to think. Oh, Chuck Latornis plays bass, and Dwayne Straub also plays bass. And it's a surprisingly good band. We've been playing together, gosh, about 6 years now. I don't want your interest rates. I'm not interested in your interest rates.
Wait a minute, what was that?
I don't know. I mean, here I am disturbing your lovely podcast with somebody offering interest. Maybe we should have broadcast that.
Yeah, and then we could have charged them for advertising.
Exactly.
There you go.
Public performance rights.
That's right.
Anyway, about Macworld All-Star Band. So we rehearse exactly once before we play. And we do it the weekend before. And this last time, the band really came together. It sounded really, really good. I was really happy to play with them. So it's a fun thing for us to do, you know, because during the week, we're all geeking out and we're all speaking and busy doing business stuff. And this is one night that we get to take off and drink beer and play loud music and have a great time.
Well, I tell you, Guy Searle and Larry, two of our writers at MyMac.com, and myself, went to that party, and I have to say you guys were fabulous that night. It was really, really entertaining. You guys are a lot more entertaining and talented than I was prepared to give you credit for when I thought, who's playing? Oh, boy, this is...
yeah, that's generally people's reaction, but it helps that Dave Hamilton, who pays... What's the bill for this thing? Provides an open bar. So,
yes, that helps, definitely.
Free drinks certainly helps. We are so much better in that second set than we were in the first.
No, you guys are really good. I was very impressed. So what is your favorite Mac of all time, not including what you have sitting on your desk right now? What's the one that got you the most excited to get, and it didn't disappoint once it was on your desk?
Wow. I think it would have to be my very first one.
Really? The Mac Plus?
Well, it was actually a 512 KE, and I got it. There was a guy I was in my band at the time. The guitar player was working at Computer Land, and he had this old Mac, and he showed it to me. And I just, you know, I'd never used a computer before, and he showed me what I could play my MIDI instrument to, and I could edit the data. And I was like, wow, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. So he was trading up to a Mac Plus, so I bought his old KE. And over time, I upgraded it and ended up being the most expensive Mac that I've ever owned. I finally put an O30 processor in this thing. I mean, it was just the Franken-Mac. And I paid $1,000 for a 100-gigabyte drive. And
it was
an amazing piece of machinery. And I just became obsessed by the thing. And what really helped was, back to my girlfriend at Mac User, is that what people don't know is that when they're finished with some of that software, they give it away to the people on staff. So she would bring home a couple of pieces of software, and I'd just load it. You know, anything that came along, I would throw it into the machine. And she said, well, is there anything else you wanted? Yes, everything. Get everything you can. And I was completely obsessed by the machine, and she would bring home boxes. I mean, literally, we went to the office one weekend, and I filled up my pickup truck with software, and I ran every single bit of it on this poor Mac Plus that was just chugging along, desperately trying to run it. And some of it wouldn't run at all because it was meant for a color Mac. I didn't care. So that had to be the most exciting machine I've ever owned. I had a 2CX after that that I really liked a lot, and I had a power computing machine that was great. Power Tower 180E was a wonderful machine.
Yeah, it was. I liked that one myself. That was a good machine. Everybody wanted the Power Tower 225.
Yeah.
That was the killer, but everyone seemed to have the 180. It was $1,200 cheaper, so.
It was far less expensive, and given what Apple was doing at the time, it was a much better machine than what Apple was turning out.
Definitely, which is why they pretty much killed the clones, because power computing, at least I thought, wasn't expanding the market, which was the mandate of all the clones. They were infringing on Apple's current customers.
Yeah, they were, and that was pretty clear to Jobs when he came back in, and he said, they're eating our lunch. You know, they promised they would expand the market, and they're not. They're just taking sales away from us. And at the time, I was at Mac User, and we did a at that time, because there were so many Mac models, we would do, you know, which is the best Mac for you feature every year. And gosh, there had to have been like 35 of them or something. Mm-hmm. And Apple didn't get a single one. I mean, we picked the top 10, and none of them were from Apple. Because
yeah,
they were so weak compared to the clones.
Mm-hmm. UMAX was getting really popular there for a while as well.
Yeah, yeah. There were a bunch of them. But Apples were just underpowered and overpriced compared to the clones.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think Apple at the time was still charging a premium, and they said, you know, I mean, obviously they put components in there that worked really well together, but companies like Power were fleet of foot. They had a much smaller staff. They could produce machines more cheaply by using less expensive parts and turn out these really dynamic machines, so they can move very quickly, too. If something faster came along, hey, we can throw that into our machine, where it would take Apple like 3 or 4 months to kind of ramp up on it. So they were always chasing the clone companies, which was hard for them to manage.
If you could cover any other industry right now other than computers or technology, what would you be covering?
Well, I used to cover games for a while. I did Computer Gaming World. I wrote for them quite a bit. And I burned out on that finally. The way to burn out on playing games is you become the game columnist for Macworld. Mm. And then, or you write books about games. And a couple of years of that, you go, okay, enough. So I would have said games. Probably music industry, because I have a deep and abiding interest in music. And still do, you know, not only performing, but digital music, too. I think I do a lot of that on PlaylistMag.com. But I'm fascinated by what's happening with media today and how it's being distributed and recorded, and how the old models have crumbled, really, that there are other ways of getting known now and distributing your music. And I think it's good. I think there's a lot of really good music that people are being exposed to now, thanks to it being distributed differently, that iTunes now is a way to do it, rather than being fed, you know, the top 20 hits on radio.
Are you kind of surprised by the merger of the music industry and the computer technology industry?
A little bit. But I think it took Apple to do it. You know, if Microsoft had been left to do this, it never would have happened, or would have happened really badly. Apple is, you know, they're smart enough to kind of see where things are going and know where people's interest lies. And they finally managed to meld two really cool things, which are gadgets or really cool machines and music. And that hits the perfect demographic for them. You know, the 18 to 24, that's what they're interested in. So it seems a logical thing that Apple went in and started doing that, and came up with such a nice way to move to the next step, that prior to Apple getting into the iTunes business, the music industry was floundering. They had no idea what to do. They were following the old model of creating CDs and then thinking, oh, well, maybe we could come up with a new format so everybody has to buy the Beatles again. Or we could find a way to copy protect this stuff. And it was just more of the same. And Apple came along and said, no, we don't have to do it that way. We can make this possible because more and more people are getting broadband. And we can make this affordable. And we don't have to rely on you guys anymore to promote music and make it popular. We can do that. And we can move to the next step. And they're starting to do that with media as well, in terms of movies and TV shows. And I think that's an interesting thing as well.
Why do you think the Beatles keep getting so much press about, oh, the Beatles going to be in iTunes soon? And I mean, you read an article like that every 3 or 4 days now, when the Beatles are going to be in iTunes. And it's been like that for at least 2 years that I can remember.
Hmm.
What do you think the big draw there is? Because I figure anybody who's a Beatles fan probably already, like me, I've already got other albums. I've already imported all my CDs at, you know, a very high bit rate into iTunes and on my iPod. So I don't get it.
Yeah, I think part of it is just simply being able to have bragging rights and say, we got them, and you guys didn't. And I think Apple will get them. They've got a nice relationship with the old Apple Records. And so part of it's bragging rights. And you're right. I have the Beatles stuff on everything. I've got it on vinyl. I've got old 45s. I've got CDs. I've got tapes. And so I'd be hard-pressed to download it and purchase it again, except, and I think this is probably what will happen, is they're going to remaster that stuff like they did with the Love compilation album, and not just sort of clean it up a little bit, but really get in there and tweak it so you can hear the instruments much more clearly than you could in the past. Mm. So it'll be like the Sistine Chapel after they cleaned it off, and you walk in and go, wow! And I think that's probably what they'll end up doing, the Beatles catalog, and sell it that way, DRM-free at higher bit rates, and they'll get people like me to buy it all over again.
So you think Apple will be, or the Beatles will be DRM-free in iTunes?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine that they're going to try to sell this stuff protected at a low bit rate like 128. Partly, I think, they haven't announced that this is going to happen because they're waiting for the DRM-free stuff to be there and then offer it.
I take it you've upgraded to 7.2 iTunes by now and gone through the finding the songs that you could upgrade. How many songs did you have to upgrade?
I had 48.
Wow.
And of those, all but 14 actually did it. Anybody who's tried to do this in the last since the iTunes store switched over yesterday have discovered that there's a lot of traffic there. And they try to upgrade their stuff, and they get the dreaded 504 error, or they get the 9006 error. And both of them basically indicate that you're hosed. And things are moving so slowly at the store that you can't get them.
Yeah, come back at 4 in the morning.
Yeah, although we heard from some guy in our forums that Apple actually sent him an email and said, don't do it now, we'll send you an email when your stuff is ready. So it's sort of like calling in for takeout. Okay, come by... Come by in 20 minutes and
your pizza will be ready.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way they're treating it because I think they're just so overwhelmed they had to.
Well, Bill Palmer at iProng actually posted a blog at mymac.com that was very critical of the idea that people are going to want to upgrade to DRM-free music, that he didn't see a big point in it and that most people wouldn't. I took exactly the opposite approach, and it looks like so far I'm right.
Yeah, I mean, just judging by the performance of the iTunes store, it seems that's the case. Although I did some A/B listening tests between the protected and unprotected versions, and really, the difference is
minute,
pretty subtle. You know, if you've got the right kind of ears, if you've got the right kind of gear to listen to it on, then it does make a difference. But if you're still listening to things on your iPod through the earbuds that are bundled with the iPod, you're not going to really tell much difference because those earbuds aren't very good. Or if you're listening in the car, you're certainly not going to tell the difference. Or on a subway. So if you're in a really great environment, it makes sense. But I think one of the things that's important about this is a lot of people have stayed away from the iTunes store, audiophiles who listen to classical and jazz, because whether they've listened to this stuff or not, they just have decided, no, this isn't going to be good enough for me, and so I won't have it. Now they're starting to go to shop at the iTunes store because they're glad to see the DRM go, and they're happy about the higher bit rates.
Out of the 358 songs that I've actually purchased on the iTunes Music Store, I had exactly one EMI tune.
Really?
I was so looking forward to upgrading some of my music, and it came back, and it was one tune. I went, wow, really? I mean, nobody really ever pays attention to what the music label is from to the songs that they're buying, but I was still kind of surprised that I only had one EMI song. Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, that's true, because there's so many sub-labels.
Exactly.
I was surprised. I didn't know if I had any, honestly. You know, I clicked it and said, I don't know. Oh, 48, huh? Who? And then I looked through and, oh, really? I had no idea they were on EMI.
Do you think Apple will ever become kind of a music company themselves? In other words, a band will sign with Apple to release their music only through the iTunes Music Store and cutting out the record labels entirely.
No, I don't think they want to do the private label thing. I mean, that's such a nightmare. And as tough and difficult as Apple can be, at heart they're not sleazy, and you need that to be in the record business.
Well, but I mean, that's the whole point, though, that maybe it's time for the entire record business to get away from the Don Kings of their industry and start working with, you know, more upfront companies that's not going to rip off the artists.
What?
Yeah.
What?
I don't know what I was thinking.
Where you been living?
He's at a Jerry Maguire moment. Just write him off right now.
Okay. I mean, I worked in the music biz for 15 years. I mean, it's they explain it to you as paying your dues. That's the nice nice way of saying, we're going to screw you over for the rest of your career, and then we're going to kick you out the door with nothing.
Here's your contract, and here's the tub of Vaseline. You
will
take
exactly.
And smile.
Exactly. So this is good for artists. They need that pain so that they can be creative. Now, running a successful music business is, of course I kid, is pretty difficult. And Apple doesn't need to get into that. They have plenty of other things they can do without starting their own private label.
Between your books and your articles and everything else that you've been doing, your video podcasts, the Mac 911, what's the proudest thing, what are you the most proud of that you've written that you can point to and say, yeah, see, that's me right there. That's what I did. Other than, this podcast right now.
Well, yeah, this would be it.
The crowning achievement.
Yes, yeah.
It is.
You can retire in happiness now.
Gosh, I don't know that I've written that yet. I'd like to write a children's book, honestly.
Really?
And I think a lot of people who write, are journalists or write about technology, they have dreams of writing something else.
Yes, I do.
It's like, oh, I don't have to do this. I want to do this. I don't know. I really like the fact that I wrote the first iPod book ever, and so I toss that around every once in a while, because at the time, even though the iPod is so successful today, at the time when it came out, it was a Mac only product. It wasn't that popular, and Peach Pit, my publisher, yeah.
I was just gonna say my first article about the iPod was very critical. I said, "This is stupid. This is gonna be a flop, and once Sony gets into this, they're gonna crush Apple."
Yeah, I think that was a lot of people's reaction. I mean, now it's, we look back and say, oh, no, of course, everybody knew it was going to be a success. It was horribly overpriced in everybody's mind. It was like, how much for what? This is an MP3 player. Are you kidding? And so it took a few months before people finally went, oh, I see how it's going to be very popular.
Yeah.
But that first volume of the iPod, Secrets of the iPod, was really just sort of done on a lark, like, well, let's see if, this turns into anything. And so the idea of writing a 150 to 200 page book on the iPod was kind of daunting at the time. But as it turns out, once I had one and looked into what it could do and what iTunes could do, there was plenty of material there, but from the outside it didn't appear that there might be.
How many volumes of that book have been published now?
Five.
Five volumes.
Five now. Yeah, and I think we're done with the big book. We split that off into the iPod and iTunes Pocket Guide, which is exactly the book that most people need. It's cheap, it's $10, and it's sold everywhere. So it's done very well. So people have found that that's the kind of little book they need for the iPod. But, at this point, nobody really cares about the history of the iPod. And, at one time, before the Internet, it was being done on the Internet, I would tear apart an iPod just to show people the inside of it and say, oh, look, here's this chip and this chip, and, who cares? But now it's sort of turned into a digital strip show where as soon as a new piece of Apple gear comes out, somebody races to tear it apart and put pictures of it up so that people can go, ooh. And I'm not sure how valuable it is other than the fact that it's pornography.
Yeah, but, tech porn, definitely.
Yeah.
And it always starts with taking off the package, so...
Yeah,
exactly.
Coming out of the box.
I find that so... I know sites do it, but I just... This, gallery of 57 pictures of unpackaging something.
Yeah.
It's like, why? Yeah, I don't...
Cellophane.
Exactly, yeah. I don't care, honestly.
I love this part.
Yeah. I mean, I understand the value of having a movie so you could kind of see what it looks like, how big it is in somebody's hand. Do a little operation on it. Show me what it does. But I don't care what the side looks like or the inside flap or that there's one sentence of the EULA that's different.
I almost did an article on this because out of curiosity, I did a Flickr search about a week after the Apple TV came out for Apple TV unboxing, and I just couldn't believe it. It was hundreds of people had their own little Flickr slideshows of unboxing the Apple TV, and I don't get it either. I mean, to me...
Well, it just shows how cool you are, that you have one.
Well, to me, half the fun of getting a new product is opening it for the first time, and that kind of, seeing the pictures ahead of time kind of ruins a little bit for me. It's, what to expect. Well, it's something new. I want to smell the plastic. I want to open it up myself for the first time and figure out what's in there, and, ooh, I didn't realize they were going to put this cable in there,
So. Okay, well, but tell me this. When you unwrap a new iPod or you unwrap something like the Apple TV, Do you very carefully take the cellophane off so that you keep it in one piece? So with the idea that maybe you'll put it back together again someday? Because I do. When I get a new iPod, I very carefully take the Do Not Steal music stuff off, and I, you know, I very carefully slip open the documentation
package. I got to be honest, Chris. I don't know if I do or not, but I'm extremely hot right now. I tell you.
Okay, well, it's a good thing I'm half a continent away from you.
Ooh, cellophane.
No, you're right.
Take it off slowly now.
It is. I mean, there's sort of this fetish about this stuff.
Yeah, with people.
And I'm the same way. I've been doing this stuff forever, and I get new gear all the time, but I'm still that way about a new product, particularly Apple products. When they come out, I do open them slowly and kind of preserve all the packaging.
How long do you keep your packaging? I mean,
I still got it.
See, no, I'm with Crystal. I still have all my stuff. So.
See, I used to, but I get so many products for review and stuff nowadays that, and I have for I don't know how long, that I was keeping everything in very pristine condition. But after a while, you're like, oh, I just finally got rid of my Xbox 360 box, and I mean, I sent that thing in because it had the red ring of death. So why am I keeping the box? I know how to use it, you know. So I finally just started throwing some. But there's still that 2 month period after I buy something. I got to keep the box.
Mm-hmm. Only 2 months. That's very good.
Well, it's a struggle, but you know, the weekly meetings are helping, and you know.
No, I've still got the box for my Wall Street Power book.
Well, let me say this though: I do have the box for my original Macintosh. The 128K, I still have the big white box. It has the manuals in there. It has the cassette tape tutorials. And I bought it at a garage sale.
Nice.
Yeah, it was like $10.
And you still have the Mac Paint and Mac Write disc?
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, that's worth something.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling myself, too.
Well, that's what I tell my wife. No, honey, we can't throw this out because someday I will die and not care. But no.
How many iPods do you own now?
You mean on premises, or how many have I purchased all together?
Well, how many do you still have?
Oh, probably 18 or so.
Yeah. Do you actually use them on a regular basis, or is it just like, in case I need to go back to the 2 gigabyte blue Nano, I have it right there?
Yeah, it's largely that, because a lot of times when we're reviewing stuff for playlist or I'm doing something for Macworld, I do have to go back to older models to find out. We just did a gear guide on the iPod, and no, I was writing a piece about audiobooks, and I needed to know how they worked on a first generation and second generation iPod. So I keep every model around so I can go back and say, this doesn't work on an older iPod. But also, like I say, I hardly throw boxes out. I'm hardly going to throw an iPod away, and I've broken several of them. So. You know, some on purpose and some not.
Some on purpose?
Yeah, I had one of the very first iPods that they gave away when they were unveiled. Because at the unveiling of the iPod, they gave everybody in the room one to take home. And, sorry. But actually, it was somebody else's, and they gave it to me because they weren't interested. And it was an editor at Macworld, and he said, this thing doesn't ship with a case, and so we want to see how much damage this thing can take before it is destroyed. So he said, I want you to destroy this iPod. I said, no, don't make me do that. He said, yes, you have to, because we're paying you. All right. So I did a test where I jogged and I dropped it on cement while it was playing, and I dropped it twice, once sideways, once straight up and down, and then another two tests on a bicycle, where it's at 25 and 30 miles an hour.
I think I read that finally, article.
Yeah, it finally flew apart in spectacular fashion. But the funny part of the story is that a couple of weeks later, Apple called me and they wanted it back because they were beta models and they had a little connector port on the inside and they wanted it back and they were going to give me another one to replace it. And I had to explain in sort of an embarrassed way that it was in pieces, and they asked how that happened, and I had to explain that as well. And there was a long pause when I said, well, so you are going to send me another one, right? And they... That took a while for them to answer, and they said, only if you promise not to break this one. I said, oh, that's okay. I promise.
They're going, that frickin' crisp brain, man.
Well, I said, it's going to come back in parts, just so you know. And it's not because I don't like it. It's, and it really did. I had to put it in a baggie because there were so many parts. And, So, yeah, they got it back. And every so often I see that person and we have a laugh over it.
Yeah, and people worry if Macworld's in Apple's pocket.
Yeah, well, you know. People are going to believe what they believe.
Well, Chris, we appreciate you coming on to our podcast this week, and we wish you all the success at Macworld, and hopefully we'll see you at the Macworld Expo in January.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.